Well, absolutely.
Thank you.
Also because, I mean, the structure is quite fluid. I'm going to write down a couple of points we can touch, but there is no way we can touch all of them, so we can kind of choose where to, I mean, what to see, what to discuss. So the main topic that I kind of had in mind was the energy momentum tensor, in particular the energy momentum tensor on the lattice. So there are two directions we can go from here. One is to really to explore the how do you define this energy momentum tensor definition. Sometimes people call it renormalization. Now this is a problem that from the conceptual point of view has been solved more than 20 years ago, I think, but might be useful to review it. then you have the practical side. Once you know how to define it, you might want to have a procedure that it's practical from the numerical point of view. And in spite of the fact that the conceptual framework appeared more than 20 years ago, there has been very few attempts to try to translate it into some practical numerical recipes, and it happened essentially all at once. So there are, as far as I understand, essentially three main approaches from the numerical point of view. So one is, this was actually for the first one to appear. It's translation worded entities, so I will use this several times. So just TWI, it's translation worded entities with shifted boundary condition. This was initiated by Leonardo Giusti, Harvey Meyer, and then picked up by Michele Pepe as well. Then there is a second approach, which is the one I'm working on. There is not a lot published on this, but this can be, except the theoretical framework, so this might be something nice to discuss. So translation worded entities with Wilson flow probes. And then there is another approach that was really started by Hiroshi Suzuki, which is the small photon expansion. Now, two out of these three approaches use the Wilson flow, gradient flow as a tool. Okay. The first one has nothing to do with the Wilson flow, but it uses this state of shifted boundary conditions. Then, okay, this is in the direction of trying to understand how to define it, how to define the energy momentum tensor, and how actually to define it in a way that you can actually calculate the normalization of the energy momentum tensor with numerical simulation. Then the other question that we might want to address is what for? And this is really more, this, if we go this way, it's really more discussion. There is an obvious motivation to study the energy momentum tensor, which is thermodynamics. Which, of course, there are other ways to study the thermodynamics, but if we really want to link the thermodynamics and the question of state to, you know, the fundamental quantities in the theory, one probably needs to go through the energy momentum tensor. And of course, this is thermodynamics of pure gauge, but one might think about real thermodynamics of real QCD, including fermions. These approaches are all approaches that in principle can be extended, even though they've been explored, and people have exploring these approaches in Purion mills mainly, but in principle you can extend them to full QCD. And then of course another possible approach, another possible application would be to study infrared conformal theory. And okay, the naive idea is very simple. The trace anomalies related to breaking of scale invariant, somehow if you have an infrared fixed point, you have some restoration of scale invariance, at least at large distance. This should be encoded somehow in the trace of the energy momentum tensor. Well, the questions are how can we use this in a practical way? And okay. I have lots of questions in this bubble here, but very little answers.
I suggested one way in my recent paper.
Very good, which I missed. So you should actually tell us about this.
About the most dimension of the scalar global operator.
Of the scalar global operator, of the F mu squared.
And then you can test also which mechanism actually originates the closing of the conformal window. So you can monitor which way.
So what's the criterion that you would...
Because of the way the anomalous dimension moves along the infrared fixed point line. It grows or it decreases depending on properties of the
So you're line. Thinking of some running...
The anomalous dimension is constrained by the trace anomaly, and therefore you can use it and it's proportional to the derivative of the beta function.
Sure. Yes. Yes. So this would require that you identify the location of the fixed point first.
And then you see how it varies along the infrared fixed point line. And the interesting thing is that depending, so in ultraviolet infrared fixed point merging implies a behavior which is opposite to the one that is predicted by perturbation theory. Nicely, very easy to recognize.
Okay.
Just to comment.
No, that's very good. I think that if we are interested in going this direction, actually you should tell us a bit more about this.
Yeah.
I mean, I had in mind something slightly, I mean, the kind of questions that I ask myself are in a slightly different direction, but of course, I mean, they're all related. Because somehow the fact that you have the, I would see the fact that you can define the trace of the energy momentum tensor as a way in which you can actually get rid of the renormalization scheme dependence that you always say when you talk about running of operators and anomalous dimensions. Of course, at the fixed point, we believe that these things become scheme independent, but the way you get there, it's very much scheme independent. If the trace of the energy momentum tensor is something that is by construction renormalization group invariant. So one question that you might want to ask is if you have a criterion that is completely renormalization group invariant to understand this kind of problem, there must be a mapping.
My point was more on the physics than on the lattice definition. So I'm not discussing the way of computing on the lattice.
Sure. No.
It's just the fact that you can extract, once you have it, you can extract information on the behavior of the anomalous dimension of the scalar.
Okay, this is, I mean, if we don't have the chance to go deeper in this discussion, I definitely want to talk more in detail about this. But I think many people would be interested in going to more details about this. Very good. So this is an interesting point already. Then there is this kind of collateral topic, which is the gradient flow. And I had some requests about going, reviewing some facts about the gradient flow. Now the gradient flow, it's a very nice technique. One has to keep in mind that doesn't really contain any physics. Okay, it's a tool that you can use in several ways. It's extremely convenient, but at the end of the day, it's a tool. Then it is used as a tool in these two approaches. So here you have the gradient flow. We might also review a few facts. In particular, there were some people who were interested in, say, a bit more in detail in how it works and how you can generalize it to other theories, essentially, which is not only pure gauge.
Investigated gradient flow is any way related to renormalization group flow?
You are not the first one who mentions this, but I don't think that anybody has really worked on this. The first thing that you might do is to use observables that you construct with the gradient flow, of course, to as the observable that you use in the matching for the Monte Carlo renormalization group kind of techniques. For instance,
so in that sense, it is used very similarly.
It is used very, very similar. The advantage is that you are matching something that has a continuum limit, so somehow it should be something safer to use rather than the plaquette itself, in which you risk to, you know, mix ultraviolet behavior.
Yeah, at some point you might say that it's an advantage that it's perturbative. Might
be
a disadvantage that it's perturbative if you want to use it in the non-perturbative measure. But that's a different issue.
But you say it's, in what sense
you
say it's perturbative?
Just said that it has the advantage.
Is
yeah.
That because it has a continuum?
No,
it has a continuum limit.
Oh, I'm sorry, but continuum limit is in the sense
of the ultraviolet fixed point. Yes, okay. Now, that's something that it might be worth to discuss. The truth is that as soon as you relax this, the idea that you want to define your theory in an ultraviolet fixed, in the Gaussian fixed point, as ultraviolet fixed point, the generalization here becomes much more difficult, I think.
There are some statements, theoretical statements, about differences with the renormalization group in the Berger papers at the beginning. Though I'm not sure I understand, so I can.
What kind of statements?
The fact that the Wilson flow is actually differs in various properties from renormalization group, other Kalman-Simons.
Ah, yes, it does. It's not,
yes.
It's not, that's clear. It's
not to define the kernel and many other properties.
I mean, the idea is that the Wilson flow can be one of the two. I mean, in the renormalization group kind of approach, you have two steps. You have the smearing and you have the rescaling. And this only provides one of the two. So the best that you can do is to, it is not renormalization flow. So the best that you can do is to use this to embed it in a.
In addition, you can also define the differential equation with a different kernel. It's not
absolutely.
Even that
no, absolutely. That's but okay. But that's the same arbitrariness that you have in defining the renormalization group flow, because you have arbitrariness in defining the blocking procedure. So that's kind of similar. The other thing is that you might be tempted to think that this is really like renormalization group equation, the Wilson flow renormalization group equation, but I would say that it's not correct. There's only one of the two ingredients. But okay, this goes in this direction. I mean, you might think how to embed this particular way of smearing fields, in which you have some arbitrariness in a fully complete renormalization procedural Wilson, I would say. It's kind of in the air, and that nobody really thought about it seriously, but I think it might be interesting.
Well, no, the calculation in perturbation theory, I mean, Lucier did explicitly, you know, if you take the gauge energy density and you do the Wilson flow with the Wilson gauge action,
yeah,
then you get a renormalized quantity that under renormalization that is finite.
Yes, but you see, you don't have any procedure. I mean, the boundary action, so the action that determines the degrees of freedom, you never change it. You never integrate out degrees of freedom. So that's only, in this sense, you can only interpret it as a systematic procedure to build normalization group invariant quantities. But you cannot interpret T as the running parameter of normalization flow a la Wilson, because you miss this step of integrating out, of writing the effective action. I mean, it's, the action never changes. It's, you're just building up different sets of observables. You never introduce really effective degrees of freedom, because you have half of the procedure that you would use. That's kind of my understanding. I don't know if anybody else to add anything on this, but my interpretation is that the statement that you build the normalization group invariant quantities really just means that these are quantities, these are observables that have a continuum limit. So you don't have to multiply them times any randomization factor. You build these observables, you take k to zero, and they're finite. And this is true as it is true for mass of states, for, of course, you need to rescale with some, you need to take dimensionless ratios. That's always understood, but it works exactly the same way as for R0, if you change the value for at which you define the Sommer parameter, you wouldn't associate that to a randomization group kind of flow. You're just changing the observable. That's it.
So in that sense, the Wilson flow is very different from spectral quantities, because the Wilson flow transformation itself averages or integrates out in some sense the ultraviolet.
Absolutely, it's very different.
That's why,
yes.
I think that it might. And I do remember Martin making a comment in his latest talk that it's not a normalization group. And I understand that it is not. But it's nice, so much
yes.
Is it not just a blocking
transformation? It's not a blocking transformation because you don't get rid of degrees of freedom. But it has all the other. I have no answer, and I'm sorry for pulling you in some.
No, it's okay. I mean, at the end of the day, you need to average degrees of freedom, integrate out the ones that your new observables are not sensitive to anymore, because you have averaged them, and then you need to take the cutoff back to its original value with the rescaling. If you have a new effective action, and then the mapping between the old effective action and the new effective action, that's the Wilson, the randomization group flow kind of. Something maybe similar would be if you try to understand in this fifth dimension what is the effective action that generates. That generates the same observables at larger flow time, but starting from a t which is different from zero. But maybe.
I don't think so.
No.
No.
I think it's Anna's argument. It's not a big. You call it flow, as Fischer called it, but it's really the diffusion equation.
Yes.
It's a diffusion equation. That has the property of softening the ultraviolet effects, which means, as you say, these new observables who have a simpler continuum limits, because the diffusion has softened the ultraviolet behavior. But that parameter is not one that relates one scale to another.
I mean, I agree. Not in this, I mean, if. I agree on the statement, yes. Not in a simple way, at least.
And what if you flowed the fields? And then you just said that the new field, the float field, is defined on some sort of lattice, which has a radius of square root of 8 tau,
so,
or something like this. So you see,
I will bet that Martin thinks that's not a good idea, precisely because he uses different letters for the float field than the original one.
But you said as a function.
He is the kind of person who would pick the notation a little bit messier than necessary because there was something behind it.
I don't know. Now this is this is a bit of.
don't think you can define a quantum field.
I think it's not a quantum field.
It was never presented as a RG flow, as far as I
know. No.
Right, so what's the issue right now?
It's just that the it's mass.
Well,
yeah, but that's just the name.
Yeah, I mean, flow is just because it's a semi group.
It's more than the name, because in practice, it removes UV fluctuations. It removes UV fluctuations at the level of square root of 8V0. And in that sense, an RG transformation does the same. It removes UV fluctuations at the level of the block.
Right, but I mean, this equation would work completely classically.
With the gauge energy density,
yes.
And you evolve with those flow, you evolve the vacuum expansion value. And there is some physics in it, because you get something that goes proportionally.
But because the initial value will be a quantum field, the end result is a function of that.
So it encodes in the Pertubeli calculation that Martin did, it encodes the information of how QCD, for example, is breaking conformal symmetry
neutral ions. No, but this I don't agree, because you, I mean, the expectation that the value of the energy density of positive flow time, I mean, you know that if you flow enough, you just get zero, because that just flows towards the minimum of the classical minimum of the gauge action.
If you flow to the infrared.
To T infinity. Now, I don't want to call it infrared exactly because I don't want to convey the idea that this is a randomization group flow, but the value of that observable doesn't mean really anything. So you cannot relate it to...
In perturbation theory, you're allowed one calculation.
Let's put it this way. If you just calculate at any finite t these quantities, this is what you would try to do with the if you want to calculate the temperature dependence of the energy density in thermodynamics. If you calculate this trace of F mu nu squared at positive flow time at temperature T minus 1 at temperature 0, which is the usual subtraction anyhow that you want to take, if you choose any T, or you think T is really a scale, so I can make it scale with capital T, for instance, or I just choose a fixed T which is different from zero, I get something that has nothing to do with the energy density, with the dependence of the energy density at finite temperature. There is only one procedure to get the correct quantity, which is to take the T, small t, to zero limit with some, okay, this is very much related to this story here, with some coefficient, which one can calculate, but you need to take this. If you stay at fixed T, you get number that has nothing to do with the energy density of a thermal system at positive temperature.
Yeah, sure, yeah. On the other hand, if I take the Wilson flow at an infrared spot, or at a fixed point, so we know that in QCD, typically the T square E quantity, T square F quantity increases linearly. In conformal systems, that T square E, instead of increasing linearly, it runs into a constant. And that constant we would identify as the coupling, or proportional to the coupling at the infrared fixed point. So in that sense, that has physics.
Yeah, but I think you got the point, because the value, if you come, it's very much like the coupling. The value of the coupling has no physical content because it's a randomization scheme-dependent quantity. What really defines the physics is the fact that you approach like a power law, that you go to a constant. And that's because you don't have any other scale, so there is nothing else that can happen.
In that case, there is a quantity where you can run T to infinity. And indeed, your configuration is practically unity or whatever, G field, yet the quantity T square U has a finite and constant.
That's right. That's right. That's right. No, that's.
Though at the beginning I was also thinking like this, but after some more thinking, I realized that the energy density always needs to go to zero at the fixed point. And in addition, being a one point function, the symmetry on homosymmetry is not constraining the powers of the wave approach. So the powers that enter in the wave approach is zero. So I can say it's a one point function. So.
The expectation of value of T mu mu at zero temperature, you mean?
So the way, if I have a fixed point, can I say something about, can the Wilson flow tell me something about the fact that there is a fixed point? At the beginning I told maybe yes, but now I think that whenever you're dealing with the Wilson flow applied to a one-point function, I cannot say.
But I mean, what Anna was saying is probably correct. The value, but also the value of T mu mu at zero temperature has no particular meaning because you always arbitrarily tend to choose your zero energy however you want. So the question is how you approach that value. If you have a power law, if you have
power law with canonical dimension or not. That's what I'm saying. That's the power law because it's a one-point function, and the only constraint is just in zero.
Okay, let's see, because the power law with the flow time, you mean?
Yeah. So the way, why in QCD it goes, T square E goes linearly, is a property of the kernel of the differential equation, and it drives the system to a minimum of the action. But there's no particular meaning so I cannot distinguish really between a system with a fixed point.
So it's tricky.
And, I'm not sure.
I mean, the naive argument might be something. We're really going in random directions here. it's probably okay, but okay. The naive argument might be this, but I wouldn't bet a lot of money on this. So this is something that has. These are quantities that are renormalization group invariant. They have a continuum limit. This is a quantity that is the energy density, the smear, the energy density, which has dimension of m to the fourth. And this is something that has dimensions m to the second. And T as well is renormalization group invariant quantity. Now, anomalous dimension appear essentially only when you have things that are not renormalization group invariant, because they run and they have an anomalous dimension. So if you say your system is conformal, which means that there is no other scale, the only thing that you can have is 1 over T squared. Well, 0 at infinity, but the way you approach it is 1 over T squared. You do have, the only scale that you have is the parameter T. With no power, because you have no lambda parameter. If you really think that you have a lambda parameter if the fixed point is only infinite conformal, but if you really believe that this lambda parameter decouples from the leading scaling term, you cannot have any other power of T because you need some other mass to compensate for the power, which you don't have here. Usually when you have an operator that runs, it's mu, is the energy scale. But in this case, these are renormalization group invariant quantities. I think that captures probably what you had in mind, no?
Yes, that's probably the best way to say.
In QCD, you do have an approximative linear behavior, but you have a scale, you have lambda that appears.
Linear behavior of T squared times E.
Of T squared times E, yes. Which amounts to a 1 over T.
Do we understand why is it linear, or is it
approximately
linear?
No, it's. I don't think there is any argument to say. In fact, if you look into the details, I don't think it's linear.
Not really linear.
I don't think it's not linear. So I don't know, as usual, yeah, you probably get information about conformality from the scaling of dimensionful quantities. But the actual numbers saying that you have physics associated to that coefficient, for instance, that's a bit hard to believe, to be honest. Okay, we went a bit in random directions. I don't know if we want to try to be a bit more systematic, but this is the things we can cover. So maybe, I don't know, we can have a poll of things that can be interesting to people and pick some of these. I don't know if everybody, probably everybody here is familiar with the Wilson flow, though I cannot bet it. So, any strong preference by anybody? Okay, it's my talk. Well, let's say a couple of things about the normalization of the energy momentum tensor, like the general framework, and then maybe some very general idea of how you use these things, how you can actually translate this general framework in practical lattice simulations. And then maybe we come back to the idea of how to use it. So at least we have a common kind of background or notation. And if at any time someone thinks, I really want to talk about one of these bubbles that I'm going to cancel now, stop me at any time. But what's the problem with the energy momentum tensor on the lattice? The problem is that the Poincaré group is broken, so you don't have another current at fixed lattice spacing anymore. So you don't have exact word identities. So this, the problem of defining the energy momentum tensor is very similar, even though a bit more complicated, to other similar problems that we have on the lattice, like defining the axial current with Wilson fermions. So the current associated to chiral transformations. Since you don't have a symmetry, an exact symmetry anymore, you need to renormalize this operator. So you need to impose word identities do not come for free. You need to impose them as a renormalization condition for your operator, essentially. Now, in the case of the axial current, the problem is extremely simple because it's just a multiplicative renormalization. In the case of the energy momentum tensor, there is a mixing problem. You have more than one operator. And how do you see what are the operators that you need to consider? Well, let's start from the continuum. In the continuum, the energy momentum tensor is an operator that has two spin parts. I'm writing everything directly in Euclidean. So we have a spin 2 part, a spin 0 part, and then we know that this operator is invariant under charge conjugation, is invariant under parity. Then if you have fermions, depending on what the masses are, you have various properties under flavor symmetry, chiral symmetry. In particular, if you have, I don't know, two degenerate flavors, it has to be invariant under the full SU2 flavor group. So when you go on the lattice, you cannot just take the expression that you have for the energy momentum tensor and discretize it naively. You won't get the right answer. You need to list all the operators that are compatible with these quantum numbers, construct a generic linear combination of these, and I should say something more, Kiminuas dimension 4. So since we are dealing with power counting, so perturbative theories or theories with asymptotic with a Gaussian fixed ultraviolet fixed point, because I have in mind pure EMILs or QCD. Otherwise, things can get more complicated. then one has to consider all operators with dimensions not larger than 4. These are the only ones that can generate divergences with the cutoff, power-like divergences or logarithmic divergences. So we need to list all operators with dimension not more than 4, compatible with these quantum numbers of gauge, of course, gauge invariant. And this task is fairly easy. The only thing that one needs to keep in mind is that when you go on the lattice, you break rotational symmetry. So the representation of the rotational group split into a smaller representation of the hypercubic group. Spin zero corresponds to a single representation to the invariant representation of the isospin group, but the spin two representation splits into two irreducible representations. It's very easy to see this because the spin two part is a symmetric matrix, which is traceless. Now, when you have a representation like this on the lattice and you start doing rotations by 90 degrees, you see that the only thing that you can do is that you can swap two axes, essentially, which means that the elements on the diagonal will mix with each other, so we'll never get out of the diagonal. So in fact, this representation splits in two parts, one that has all zeros on the diagonal, and is still symmetric, and one that is zero off diagonal. It has 4 elements with the constraint that the sum is zero. So this is a dimension 6 representation, this is dimension 3 operator representation. So in Purian Mills, we have 3 operators to consider. And there is only one operator in the singlet representation, which you obtain by discretizing naively f mu squared, f rho sigma squared, and I need to write sum. And you can choose whatever discretization for f mu that you want. The Clover-Plaquette, for instance, is totally fine. Then you have the, let's write this one, it's a bit simpler. So the symmetric part with all zeros on the diagonal, this is you have a sum over rho, trace of f mu rho, trace of f mu rho. Then this has elements on the diagonal, so what I need to do is just to subtract, multiply times this. So this quantity here is zero when mu is equal to nu. So this kills all the elements on the diagonal. And then you need the ones on the diagonal, which, OK, you need the ones on the diagonal. It has to be traceless. If you work out all the details, you get something like this. So this corresponds to a matrix that has elements only on the diagonal with sum equal to zero. The energy momentum tensor is going to be a general linear combination of these 3 operators with 3 unknown constants. Then there is still something that we need to take care of, which is the mixing with the identity. So this is really something, it's gauge invariance is really important here. The fact that you have only dimension 4 operators is because of gauge invariance. But you do have the mixing with the identity, which means that if you calculate the expectation value of these operators, of course you're going to get the expectation value T6, since this is not invariant under rotation, it's going to be 0. The expectation value of T3, this is going to be 0. But if you calculate this for a generic definition, well, this is going to be delta mu nu, and it's going to be something that diverges with the cutoff, with the fourth power, with some function which depends logarithmically with cutoff. And this is just power counting. So this is what Usher people call mixing with the identity, and this is something, this is a divergence that one needs to subtract, so we do it like this. And you can set the finite value of Timmy new, the expectation value of Timmy new, to whatever value you want. I mean, the word identities are completely insensitive to this finite value. So in particular, we can choose it to be equal to zero. This is the definition of the energy momentum tensor, except that we don't know this constant Z alpha, and we need to have a way to determine them. Okay, now just to see what happens with fermions, if I've listed all the operators correctly, I kind of have the feeling that I forgot one, but one can go back to the original paper by Caracciolo, Pellissetto, Menotti, and find them out. It should be, you should have a fermion, you should have these other operators. The derivative with the double arrow is the one which acts on the right minus the one that acts on the left, and this is the only charge conjugation even combination that you have. And then you have the, you need to symmetrize because the energy momentum tensor is in the symmetric representation. Okay, and here we go. I found out the one that I forgot. This one breaks in two pieces because you have the part off diagonal and the part on the diagonal. So you have, in fact, you have to take the off diagonal part and the diagonal parts. So this really corresponds to two operators once you do this separation. And then you have the trace. And then you have the master, if you have us. So it's seven operators. So the mixing is fairly, it's fairly complicated. But the structure of the normalization is exactly the same one. So you see that, I mean, this looks like a completely hopeless problem. We have several operators. Either we find a completely efficient way to calculate these coefficients numerically, or there is no way we're going to do it. It's true that there is some hierarchy. There is, okay, you have equation of motions. If you put the energy momentum tensor away from any other operators, that is a combination that vanishes because the equation of motion, so it's minus one. This one has a hierarchy because it's the only term that breaks chiral symmetry. So okay, you can massage this problem and really decompose this normalization into a kind of five plus one renormalization. Still, it's a huge number of operators. So how do we fix these operators? This is the first issue. And what you really want to do is to impose the word identities. So we know that in the continuum, but we need to understand exactly what kind of word identities we want to impose. Because if you just open your textbook, you read word identities, you're going to find some very nice word identities that you usually derive in a regularization that doesn't break translational invariants. So in particular, not only the energy momentum tensor is well defined, but also all the contact terms of the energy momentum tensor with any field are well defined. And we don't have this luxury on the lattice. So the first thing that we want to try to understand is how to write word identities which are free of contact terms. And this is, okay, it's very simple, in fact, to write them. Because the first thing that you can say is that, okay, in the continuum, I know that something like this has to hold. if all these points are separated, this expectation value has to be zero. Where, of course, when we have local fields and we want to impose this on the lattice, we need to make sure that we have renormalized. Well, okay, if this field is renormalized multiplicatively, zero is zero, so it doesn't matter. So if we use low dimensional operators, this is a safe procedure. And you can do this. So what you can do, you can calculate this two-point functions, three-point functions. You can insert that expression. You use three of them, three worded entities that you, well, OK, the first thing to observe is that you cannot determine the three coefficients, because this is an homogeneous equation. So the only thing that you can do from here is to fix two of them, or the ratio of two of them with respect to the third one. So you can choose two worded entities like this one, and these are going to fix two of these three coefficients. Now, the fact that we know that you have a continuum limit tells you that once you've chosen two completely random conditions to fix these two coefficients, and use these two coefficients in another possible worded entity, you will get, of course, not exactly zero, but zero up to all the effects. So something that has a continuum limit, and the continuum limit goes to zero. How do you fix the overall renormalization? The overall renormalization, you fix it by, after all, this equation doesn't tell you that these are the translation worded entities. This just tells you that T mu is conserved. So how do we require that the energy momentum tensor is actually the generator of translations? You do it like this. You integrate over a surface. Use the Gauss theorem. Now, this is not zero, of course, because this equation is valid everywhere except where z hits one of the points. So you sort out what this needs to be, and you find that it's just equal to this. So we have a volume, V. We have certain points, x1, x2, z. Some of them are inside the volume, some of them are outside the volume. You just get this. You just get sum over all the points that are inside the volume, derivative with respect to this coordinate. Now, this is telling you that this is the charge of translations, because this is an infinitesimal translation of the fields. This is all very nice. In principle, it works, except that, of course, here you need, if you look into the details, you cannot use only the insertion of one field, because you would get the derivative of one field, and by translation invariance, that's zero. So you need to use at least two fields. So you have a three-point function here, a two-point function there. You need to be sure that the volume scales, everything scales with a physical length, so you never have to have that x1 goes on top of x2, so the distances have to scale with the physical length. And this problem becomes a nightmare also, because when you start taking these fields far apart, you lose the signal, and so there is no way in which you can determine these coefficients with a decent precision. So this is the problem. The question is, okay, this is a very simple-minded kind of application of the word, and it's the textbook one, because usually you write everything in terms of local operators. From the numerical point of view, that might not be the best thing to do. So the question is, can we derive other worded entities, always translational worded entities, but with different probes? So this is what I'm going to call probes here. In which essentially, for instance, you get rid of problem of contact terms. You are not afraid to put one operator on top of the other. Or maybe you can reduce the amount of fields that you need to insert in these expectation values. You need only one instead than three. Is this possible at all? Well, the two approaches that try to solve this problem are exactly these shifted boundary conditions. And this is interesting because in this kind of approach, the probe for the world identities is not an operator. The probe for the world identities is the geometry itself, which I think is a very smart idea. So what you do is you essentially take expectation values of the energy momentum tensor with different kind of geometry. So it's the torus is a torus with a shifted boundary conditions, and you get relations that fix the normalization of the energy momentum tensor. The other possibility is kind of obvious from the previous discussion is to use probes at positive flow time. Why do you want to do that? Because these operators, they have, again, this is a tool that I'm not attaching any physics to these operators here. I'm using them as a probe. All the physics here is in the energy momentum tensor. But these probes have very good renormalization properties. Now, in some cases, they do not renormalize at all. In some cases, they renormalize very easily. They don't have contact terms. So you might say, if I use fields with at positive flow time here, maybe I can avoid this integral in the first place. So you write a completely local world identity, which doesn't have contact terms, and so I can get something that I can calculate much more easily with a reasonable accuracy. Okay. These are the two strategies. The third strategy, which is the small flow time expansion. It goes in a completely different direction. I mean, you might embed it with translation world identities, but it's not the version which it's commonly presented right now. This small flow time expansion is really something like an operator product expansion, and the condition that you impose in order to fix these coefficients, which get mapped in other coefficients in functions of the flow time, are that the operator is the right one in the perturbative regime. So when you, for instance, you define these coefficients, you calculate expectation value of energy momentum tensor with some insertion of field, and you don't require that the expectation value that some world identity is satisfied. For instance, require that maybe if you just calculate this expectation value in a very, very small volume, you reproduce the result that you would get in perturbation theory in a regularization that preserves translational invariance, which you can calculate everything. So it's a kind of matching problem, more traditional renormalization problem, which you match with perturbation theory. The idea is that at the end of the day, you are going to recover the same operator because there is no freedom in defining the energy momentum tensor. So if you use that operator that you define that way in world identities, you should get that world identities are satisfied anyhow. But in this approach, world identities are not imposed as a constraint for the renormalization of the operator.
In the second one, that we use probes at positive flow time, do you have to take the flow time to zero limit?
No, you don't, because the energy momentum tensor is defined as a local operator. And this is the operator our target, or you don't flow it. This is the target operator. And here, you really can put anything you want. Okay. From the point of view, if you have a cutoff, of course, here you can choose any complicated function of the observable. If you represent dimensional regularization, you can put any complicated observable here. You will always be able to write down a world identity for that probe, because the world identity at the end of the day is just a change of variable in the path integral. Now, the problem is, once you choose a very complicated observable, can you actually remove the cutoff? You get something that is finite in the continuum limit. That's not the obvious thing. And that's where the Wilson flow helps. So you really get a quantity that has a finite continuum limit. But it has to be valid for, if you use a probe at positive flow time, the world identity has to be the right one for any positive flow time. Because world identity probes the symmetry, it doesn't probe the structure of the observable here. Okay, this is a good time to stop, and maybe this is very general. first thing that I would ask you is which one of these you want to hear about. And if you have any questions about this general story. Any preference, anybody?
Can you repeat why you were looking for these alternate solutions to?
Okay, this strategy in principle works. Mm-hmm. So the problem is that, first of all, if you want to impose this kind of constraint, you cannot use less than two fields. This is partially correct because you can start playing also with background kind of boundary conditions that use a background field which is not translational invariant. So you might lose one field that way. But for sure, you need to keep this volume, you know, the distance, even if you manage to reduce everything to one point in the center of this volume. This volume is a square because that's the easiest thing that you can calculate on you can construct on the lattice. Now this the size of this square, this d, this has to scale to the continuum limit as a physical length. So you say this has to be one Fermi, and I will define these coefficients which depend on g0 by imposing this equality at different lattice spacings, while keeping this distance always one Fermi. And now, of course, the problem is that it's already quite a problem to scale the volume itself. The problem is that you have an integer number of points. So, okay, if you have a volume which is 8, you might multiply it times 2. You might multiply it times 3 over 2. But then if you start dividing the volume in a subdomain which you're integrating, that's a dimension. This is a 4, so this is 2. And then you want to have a sequence of points in which you scale everything with the lattice spacing. You very easily end up with huge
lattices. Why do you necessarily want to take the continuum limit?
Okay, the procedure is this. The procedure is that.
No, otherwise you get a renormalization constant which has discretization
effect. Well, the renormalization constant is purely cutoff effect, if you wish. Mm-hmm. But let's say that you want to calculate T mu at fixed temperature. Okay. So what you will have? You will have several lattices with nt equal to 4, nt equal to 6, nt equal to 8, so on and so forth. You will have a value of beta here, a value of beta here, a value of beta here, in such a way that the temperature, the physical temperature, is always the same, fixed. Now what you need is a value of this z here, a value of this z here, and value of this z here. And now if you have a setup, you need to have a setup that has a continuum limit. That's the word identity, you need to impose it in the continuum limit. So you need to have a setup in which all the distances, all the energies, you rescale them with the same ratios. And so you have a setup. You calculate z, you scale everything, you adjust beta exactly in the same way. You calculate z and again, and then you attach this z to the bare one, and then you calculate the expectation value of t mu nu here, and you get your continuum limit.
Now, I didn't understand why fixed beta you would need to take a continuum limit.
That's why, because this you need to plug it in a calculation in
which
you will take the continuum limit. So everything has to scale with these funny ratios, and of course, if you start fractioning your lattice in sub-volumes, that becomes already quite difficult. So either you have a huge number of points, so you won't be able to do it. The Wilson flow is very nice from this point of view because the parameter is a continuous one. So it doesn't pose this problem. The boundary conditions is also very nice from this point of view because you don't need to fraction the volume. Here, you rescale just the volume exactly in the same way in which you would do in your thermal setup. The only thing that you need to change is the boundary conditions. So the real problem here is that you need to integrate over a subregion that has to scale with the lattice spacing essentially. And you cannot integrate over the whole volume because otherwise you just get expectation values of derivative of product of fields which is zero by translational invariance. This is very different from the axial current. In the axial current life, it's much easier. Because because the symmetry is spontaneously broken, so even expectation values of the Carrel condensate is different from, which is not Carrel invariant, is different from zero because the symmetry is spontaneously broken. And this allows you to lose one field in this chain. You don't have the same in the case of translations.
But even if you use Wilson flow, don't you want to take the continuum limit?
Absolutely.
At the end of the day?
Again.
Repeat the same thing at
So in this calculation of the thermodynamics, there is no Wilson flow anymore. Because here I've got my randomization coefficients from whatever condition I have. I plug them here, T mu nu is at flow time equal to zero, and I take the continuum limit. So the flow time appears only in these conditions, in which here you have also T, you have dependence with T. And of this, you need to rescale all the dimensionful quantities in the world identities with lattice spacing, which means that yes, you will need to change the value of T in lattice units as you change beta in such a way that the physical value
but
of T.
But just the Wilson flow scale, so they don't
But if I understood you right, you only flow the probes, you don't flow the energy.
Yeah, nevertheless, you need to rescale everything because otherwise you end up, because you do have these quantities are all defined.
Scale your
It's the equivalent of scaling the surface. In this case, you don't have a surface anymore because you're integrating, but you have the Wilson flow, which is the range over which you are integrating your fields. The thing is that these quantities are defined up to lattice artifacts, and some lattice artifacts are of the type A times power of T A square over T, for instance. So if you change T while changing the lattice spacing, you're changing this term. While you want to keep all the dimensionful quantities fixed, such a way that the only quantity that is changing is really only A. So you do your extrapolation in A squared.
But when you do it at one beta value, then your A is fixed.
Yes, but then you have to redo at the other beta that you need for the second simulation.
So then
in order to keep the lattice artifacts uniform, so the coefficient in front of the terms A squared the same, you need to rescale everything in the world identity with the lattice spacing. So the whole procedure has to be a procedure which in principle you might do directly in the continuum limit. So everything has to scale in the correct way.
So the goal at this point is to get those Z alpha, the six or seven, or
yeah,
how many?
Let's see the three of them for the case of
the three Z alpha coefficients.
Yes.
And those at the fixed lattice spacing or a fixed beta, you have some procedure,
yes,
and you will get three Z alphas. And I understand that they will have lattice artifacts or corrections.
They will have lattice.
And then you will take the continuum limit, which is a totally different procedure.
Yeah. Exactly.
But at one fixed beta, in principle, you could use any of those three. The shifted boundary.
Yes, but you are not allowed to change prescription for the same continuum limit because that would amount to changing the factors in front of the terms A squared in the coupling constant that you are.
So are you saying that you simply have to repeat the same?
Yes, exactly the same procedure.
Procedure at different beta values. So in some sense, continuum limit is continuum limit.
Yeah, I mean, this is a universality argument, yes. The continuum limit is whatever it is, and the only thing that you know is that once you multiply these three operators, they have an arbitrariness in being defined because you can choose different discretization. The Z, they have an arbitrariness, which comes with the fact that you can choose different recipes. When you multiply all of them, this arbitrariness combines in such a way that it amounts only to cutoff effects. So you have an operator that has a continuum limit, and the only arbitrariness is in front of the coefficients or order A squared. And that's why you don't want to change the procedure, because at every value of beta, you want those coefficients to be always the same in such a way that you can do your fit with one parameter, let's say. yeah.
So when you use your probes at different flow times, the lead is changing, it's also changing with the loads of flow.
So the Wilson flow again has to be kept constant in physical units. So clearly in lattice spacing it will change with the lattice spacing. In a way that you know though, because if you know that these two betas correspond to the same physical quantity and the ratio between nt is 4/6, this tells you what's the ratio between the lattice spacings, which tells you what's the ratio that you have to use between the two t's that you need to use to calculate the z in these two setups. Another thing that is worth to point out is that, of course, if you manage to write some completely local word identity, you can really calculate these word identities. These are word identities under translation, so you can calculate at finite volume. So you fix a size for your torus in which you are defining your procedure to normalize the energy tensor. The size of the torus has to scale in the same way. So, for instance, you can fix the ratio between square root of 80 with volume, and everything has to scale in the same way. And you have, again, you have a perfectly correct definition of your quantities z that are different from, for instance, a prescription infinite volume only up to terms order a or a squared, depending on the theory we're looking at. I'm not paying attention to the time.
It's 4:40. Maybe in 20 minutes, 15. Can it be done?
Sorry?
Has this been?
Okay. Let's see what's been done. This procedure relies on a perturbative calculation and on the ability to take the small t expansion. I think that if you ask different people, they will tell you different answer. I don't think personally that all the systematic effects are under control in this procedure, because you're adding an extra limit, and this extra limit is fairly delicate. Okay. This works beautifully well for two of the three renormalization constants, and there are results already which are extremely precise for the these two, the renormalization coefficient of these two. Of course, not the trace. The trace is always the hard one, but of these two operators, and it works really, really very well. This has a problem of scaling to larger volumes, because since we're probing with boundary conditions, at some point you might lose signals if your box becomes too large. Or if you have too many points, or so, which means if you're going to the continuum limit, but in practice this might not be an issue. Now the authors here, they claim that they have some results for the renormalization of the trace, but they're not published yet, so I don't know. This is the one that I'm working on mainly at the moment. There is nothing published about. Okay, there is some preliminary result in the. The lattice talk of my student, Francesco Capponi. And here what we observe is that the method works essentially equally well for the three of them. In fact, you get the three of them at the same time. And if you just rescale the kind of simulations that you need here, it seems that it works essentially, you know, they use very big lattices. Here, their procedure is really based on the fact that you have a finite T, but a large volume. And they take some extrapolation. Here, this one, you can use it on small volumes. So if you rescale the number of configurations that we had to generate here with the volume, you get some like comparable kind of computer time. The thing is that we don't seem to need an extra effort to get the coefficient of the trace. You get a larger relative error, but an absolute error which is kind of comparable, because the coefficient in the regime that you are exploring, the coefficient of this term here is smaller than the others. This is something, the coefficient of this one is something that is order g squared. The coefficient of these two is something that is order one. So it's not obvious yet. I think as long as the two these two methods are comparable, it's they should both be explored together, because then the main point is how the picture changes when you try to include these operators as well. So to see if they remain comparable also when you have fermions.
They are comparable in computer.
In computer, so.
How about in prediction? Are they
consistent? They are, yes, they are consistent. So the AC check that you can do, it works very well. I can show you some preliminary plots. I've not prepared them, but if someone is interested, we can look at them later. What you can do is to essentially to calculate these ratios. For instance, Z6 calculated with one method over Z6 calculated with another method. Now, each one of these coefficients doesn't have, in the continuum limit, what you know is that they need to go to one. But you don't know how they are going to go to one. They don't go. You don't have an effective kind of semantic expansion in terms of a square powers of these coefficients, because they depend on g, and g depends logarithmically on the coupling constant. So you cannot take one and say I fit this with one plus a squared plus whatever. But the ratio, this does have an expansion in a squared. And so in fact, you can do a fit, and this fit work. I mean, for 6 and 3, 6 is more precise than 3, than this one. So for this one, you can really test this, and you can really fit this only with an a squared term in a range of volumes. In our calculations, we are using n equal, a hypercubic lattice, n to the fourth, and n is equal to 6. 8, 10, 12, 16. Everything is scaled, so beta is matched in such a way that the physical volume is the same. And you need to drop this one, but the other ones are on a perfectly straight line. And on Z6, we're talking about a relative error of a bit more than 1% with a modest computational effort. So it does work.
And you don't have to increase the volume as you go towards the continuum.
You need to increase the lattice space, the number of lattice points, but not the physical volume.
Oh, that is in some sense physical.
And it's the number of points, but beta is matched in such a way that the physical volume is always the same.
I have one question. Is there any, I always wanted to know this, is there any point to flow the target operator. I mean, you could flow T.
You want to flow T.
Use that for your physics, because it's perfectly fulfill all the symmetry and the requirements, right? And maybe this helps because of the maybe killing short distance noise.
Yeah. Okay. That's how it works. This is related to the flow time expansion. It's true, you kill the noise, but you also modify the operator. So the team you knew.
Excessively, yes. But you don't want to do that. You just want to flow to modest amount of time.
Well, if you flow by a modest amount of, it doesn't matter how little you flow, you modify the operator. So it's a matter of precision, if you wish.
Yeah, but that's I can define this is my operator, and I will measure the matrix element using that operator.
So the problem is how you take, because here the problem is always a problem of continuum limit. So here is the question is whether you get the right operator in the continuum limit or not. Do you have in mind? Do you want to scale? How do you want to scale the flow time? That's the relevant question. Do you want to keep it constant in physical units, or do you want to keep it proportional to the lattice spacing? that's the same applies to any fixed flow time, right? You have to define the time for to be able to say this is a my fixed time.
But also the mixing, right? Because you can you cannot anymore. You don't have a definition of what is your operator at
each time. This is my. I'm fixing, you know, flow time.
Yeah.
Temperature square or something. And then, you know, then for each data, you definitely flow. And yes, this has the discretization error, but this is, you know, not special from any other discretization error. We just fix the, you know, this is the fixing procedure of having the same extrapolation.
Okay, the question is, do you want to have a procedure that in which you get an exact nether current in the continuum or not? Because this operator that we find this way doesn't satisfy the mu t mu nu equal to zero at any value of t. Doesn't matter how small. Now, of course, because it's you don't have arbitrariness in defining the nether current. The nether current is in the continuum is uniquely determined by the nether. Okay, but the problem is that when you define something a positive flow time that has a continuum limit, which is not the operator at zero flow time. So you get a different one.
That's what
they decide. So if you define something like this, okay. Let's see how it works. It works like this. You can define something like g mu nu, f mu nu, f mu rho, f mu rho, plus, okay, with some coefficient. Now, first of all, if you define something like you naively take the expression that you have in the continuum limit at fixed cutoff, which means this one, this operator is traceless, and it stays traceless in the continuum limit at any positive t, because these pieces have a continuum limit independently. It's a positive flow time. This is the flow time. So, okay, this is the expression that you would write like in dimensional regularization, for instance. And you know the trick. What's the trick there? Is that dimension is different from four. So this is an operator. This is divergent. One over epsilon times epsilon. That you get a contribution to the trace. If you construct this operator a positive flow time, exactly in this way, you take the continuum limit. You get an operator whose trace is exactly zero. So this is the first thing that tells you that you're not constructing the right thing. And then the other thing is that this is not true anymore anyhow, as an operator. You cannot prove it. I mean, this is, I mean, equal to zero is not true anymore. What you have is the divergence is different from zero.
For each of that spacing, you are declaring that. Right?
Yes, but if you take a positive flow time, there is no renormalization to be taken. So here, the thing is that
you can. I'm solving the fixing.
Yeah. So can one just take those equations and flow not only the probes but t and define t?
This is not only the t mu nu, the or the any operator, one dimensional.
Okay.
Let me
reverse the argument. Let's see if we're saying at least the same thing, because I mean the way in which you can use operators of positive flow time to define the energy momentum tensor is this. So you define this operator here, and you call it U, and then you have your usual E. Now, what you know is that you can find two coefficients. Okay, let me write the expression, then we can try to understand why. So you can find two coefficients which depend on t, which are kind of the analogous of the Z, but they're different. It's different in many respects. But you can find two coefficients. Such that when you take t to 0, this is the energy momentum tensor. How do you prove this? You prove this, this is really reversed operator product expansion. You take this operator here, let's start from this one. In fact, I should subtract the expectation value. You take this operator here. Now, this operator here, you have a bunch of fields that are integrated over a finite region. It's a normalization group invariant. When you take, so you have this ball in which you have all your fields, and the size of this ball is square root of 8t. Now, when you take t to infinity, the support of this operator becomes a point. So this, you can express it as a sum of local operators, operator product expansion. And what determines which are the operators that are important? Dimensional analysis. So this has a mixing with the identity, which is something that goes like 1 over t squared at small t. And then you have the first operator that appears is a dimension four operator. Now, if you have Empyrean mates, there is only one, the trace of the energy momentum tensor, times a Wilson coefficient, which depends on t. And then you have higher dimensional operators. Same thing applies for U. So for U, you don't have the identity. You have only the mixing with the spin 2 part of the energy momentum tensor with a coefficient. So you can reverse these equalities and reconstruct the energy momentum tensor. But you need to take this limit, because if you don't take this limit, you end up with contributions from higher dimensional operators, which have nothing to do with the word identities. They break the fact that divergence is zero. They give you a random operator. And this has nothing to do with the fact that you have a finite lattice spacing or not, because all these quantities individually and separately have a continuum limit. So you can write this directly at fixed lattice spacing, directly in the continuum. It doesn't matter. It works exactly in the same way.
But you define E of t for each of t in the continuum.
Yeah.
And then you can extrapolate. I guess that's
that. You need to know this coefficient.
You could fit, right?
No, this coefficient has a logarithmic behavior with t.
It's, you're doing the, like you said here, the loss of the OP. So you have finite,
maybe a higher order. This is t proportional to t squared. If you fix these z everywhere for each of t. I think you're getting it. Let's restrict to a private thing.
No, I'm sorry because I.
No, no, of course.
I think I learned a lot. And it's good to have more questions, but we should thank
Agustin. Thank you.